Next witness is Mr. Evans.
My name is Ian Evans. I'm employed by the Southern District Council as its Strategic Water and Waste Manager. SDC is responsible for the operation and maintenance, renewal and upgrading of 19 community wastewater schemes, 20 community and stock water supplies, and 27 community stormwater schemes. Given the amount of individual consents held and the anticipated further consents being issued for the stormwater activity and potentially closed landfills, SDC is likely to be impacted heavily by the rules within the proposed Southland Water and Land Plan, both in financial and non-financial terms. It is therefore important that the anticipated costs reflect the benefits that they are expected to deliver. The evidence that I have submitted gives a range of examples from an SDC perspective. It is fair to say that the concerns and issues that I have raised are similar across all three of the territorial local authorities, although the emphasis or focus is likely to be different given the nature of the activity and infrastructure across the three organisations. Paragraph 5 outlines our compliance record against our wastewater resource consents for contaminants. It shows an improving trend, which is currently sitting at 98% for the first half of this year. So although we do have some non-compliances in terms of flow and flow exceedances, it's generally in wet weather, the compliance record is upwards of 90%. SDC is conscious of the importance of ensuring potential impact on Māori is taken into account when planning for infrastructure upgrades, and we have developed a strong working relationship with Teo Marama Incorporated as the agency recognised to represent Te Rātunga o Ngāi Tahu on such matters. Given their close interest in water, Teo Marama Incorporated are always consulted when undertaking significant infrastructure projects. A recent example of that has been the consented upgrade at Te Anau, where Teo Marama sat on the infrastructure working group that came up with the consented solution. The TLA has recognised the need to improve water quality across the region and that everyone has a role to play in how this is delivered. However, there are concerns that the way that proposed plan proposes to manage discharges from critical infrastructure because it may not achieve the desired outcome and has the potential to have a significant impact on community affordability, as Mr. Ruru touched on earlier. In terms of critical infrastructure, as providers of critical infrastructure, the TLAs are all concerned that its importance is not appropriately recognised within the proposed plan, and that some of the objectives, policies and rules can be viewed as not providing for the ongoing expected use of such critical community infrastructure. This infrastructure plays a key part in providing the health and well-being of the TLA's ratepayers, as well as environmental protection, enabling economic development across the region. From an SDC perspective, one key example of the importance of infrastructure in promoting economic development can be seen in Te Anau, where the level of tourism growth would likely be considerably restricted were it not for the provision of the high quality infrastructure. If I turn now to policy 14, the preference for discharge to land. In respect of policy 14, acknowledging the preference for discharges to land over discharges to water, I would comment that SDC does operate a number of land-based discharges and will always consider land-based disposal options during the resource consenting process, as evidenced by the recently granted Te Anau wastewater consent. However, I would comment that land-based discharges are not always achievable or practical, certainly in areas it could be limited to not possible all year round. Where this is not possible, provision is needed within the rule framework to allow some form of appropriate discharge to water to be considered on a discretionary basis. On rule 33, classifying wastewater discharges as non-compliant activities either under rule 6 or rule 33 fails to provide for the direct benefits that reticulated networks provide to communities as well as to the environment. While there is more that could be done, matters such as impact and repairs and overall timing of upgrades is critical to ensure that the right balance is struck. A number of locations across the district where water is degraded upstream of discharges, it is important that the timing of any upgrade is timed to ensure that they deliver the biggest and most lasting environmental benefit. With this in mind, SDC is currently looking at a way of prioritising how future upgrades will be carried out to ensure that this is delivered. In relation to the policies and rules around community water supplies, the TLAs are supportive of any approach which provides certainty around the provision of water supply for domestic needs, given the importance of water both in terms of public health and economic development. While recognising the strategic importance, the TLAs are also mindful of the need to ensure that taking water for all uses is managed in a long-term sustainable manner. In my evidence, I have specifically referred to an instance where SDC incurred a significant cost to source a new supply from a different location because the aquifer was over-allocated. The TLAs understand the need for demand management and have steps in place to minimise impact. These range from a leakage detection and repair programmes, examples of which we have carried out recently in Tiana and other communities, strategic metering through all parts of our network on our community water supplies, which is an ongoing programme, to the full-scale renewal of aged and leaking infrastructure. An example of this is the current investment of close to $2 million for replacement water mains in Minton that's happening now. If we turn to Rule 52, water abstraction in the Wyre catchment. This is one of the rules that impacts an SDC alone as it relates to the taking of water from the Wyre catchment. A specific concern is that as our towns grow, and in particular Tiana, and potentially to a lesser extent Manapouri, the need will be there to provide additional water, which is likely to eventuate. We are concerned that under this rule, it is likely to make it more difficult to apply for a consent for an increased take, or that this could stifle growth in the communities, particularly given the insignificant volume that is represented when compared to the flow in the overall catchment. Whilst I do believe that it may not have been the intent to capture these water takes under this rule, I also believe that it is more appropriate that the community water takes are adequately and appropriately covered under Rule 50. In a query from the Commissioner, I refer to a query as to why certain water supplies were omitted from Appendix J, the drinking water protection zones. It is my understanding that the supplies referred to in Appendix J only include water takes serving populations of over 500. The query from the Commission is specifically related to the Manapouri supply, which serves a population of less than that, and that therefore was not included. On reviewing the SDC water takes under that appendix, it was noted that the recently constructed Edendale Wyndham water supply scheme serves a population of greater than 500, and it was recommended that should be included under that the appendix. In conclusion, it is recognised that all parties have a part to play in improving water quality. This can come with some significant financial cost to communities, and it is imperative that the benefit derived from this investment clearly represents value for money and takes into account affordability, especially to communities with ageing and declining populations. There should also be a much greater recognition of the benefits derived from critical infrastructure and provision clearly made for the operation, maintenance and upgrading of that infrastructure, which is essential and needed in the long term. The proposed water and land plan currently fails to recognise and account for this appropriately in the ways I have outlined. Thank you.
Thank you. See if we have questions for you, Lord.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just referring to your speaking notes, section 12. It's my understanding that there is a 200 litres per head per day formula for calculating demand for water. Is that sort of roughly in the same area?
Probably that, yeah.
Yep. And my point is, have you, considering your comments in that section, have you considered water storage on farm, in other words, used in rainwater captured on the property to actually soften the demands that you would need to take from water takes?
It's something that will be outlined or supported through the land development bylaw, but certainly it's probably less able to do that in our urban communities.
Why?
I think just the space restrictions in some of the sections might make it just a little bit more difficult. But it's certainly something that we would have to probably look at, certainly where we have declining communities.
Thank you, Chairman. That's all.
No questions. Thank you.
Yes, my earlier question to Mr. Hurley was really looking at how much, the number of land infiltration treatment systems that the SDC has. And I see on your table one, there's, you've got a list of your primary evidence, a list of those that go to land or to water. But I don't know that that's indicating what's land infiltration. Parts in particular, or are they?
Yeah, the ones that are the discharge pathway is land infiltration. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay.
So it's something we do have a number of them, and it will always be considered as part of the consenting process.
And you've answered the question as well. It really was stimulated by the NATO position on land treatment, their preference for that, and just in the way that you handled that. But I see you have seem to have some sort of protocol.
Yes.
That works with the Te Ao Marama.
Yes, yes. Very successful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edmund. Just in relation to Rule 52, and this might be a question that Mr. Garbutt could address as well. The wire catch is special because of the water take for the power scheme, of course, and Meridian are very keen to hang on to the water that they've got. And I'm sorry if you've suggested a recommendation how we can get around this other than going to Rule 50, which doesn't really address the issue of the wire. How can we resolve this problem? Well, you've got an increase in take potentially, the town now increasing in population, and the situation of the wire with the water take for the power scheme, especially from surface water and connected groundwaters, is quite difficult. Have you got any suggestions as how we can resolve that?
I think from my perspective, I was highlighting the pretty much when you compare what we take to the overall what goes down the catchment, it is relatively insignificant. And questioning whether it needs to be covered by a non-compliant activity status to increase that.
Yeah, the answer from my perspective is that Rule 52, it is requiring a consent for the take. It's not permitted in any way, so it's still got to go through a consenting. The hydraulic connection requirement has to be met to be discretionary, and the problem we foresee is that they're all hydraulically connected, so they'll always be non-compliant. So if you deleted the hydraulic connection, at least for the TLAs, then at least that overcomes the activity status defaulting to non-compliant.
But does that address the issue that Meridian had at the moment as the operators of the power company in relation to their consent, which they have been granted to take basically all the surface water in that catchment?
Yeah, whether the consent is discretionary or non-compliant is not derogating from Meridian's rights. It's just imposing the threshold test on the council's application.
Okay.
So we're not saying that it's permitted or there's certain quantity allocated at all. So any application has to be made, we're saying to you that it ought to be a discretionary proposal rather than non-compliant. Now, Meridian's position on that application will be advocated by Meridian, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Just in terms of that last issue, if the officers could address this matter in reply, my understanding, and I stand to be corrected, is that the YR catchment is fully allocated from a surface water perspective, so even if it was a discretionary activity, there'd be no ability to grant the application if it was for an increased volume. To me, that seems to be the more crucial matter, and I'm not sure how that can be overcome, if it can be overcome at all, but can you address that in reply? Just to confirm whether that is the case and if there is any way through that issue.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm just returning, Mr. Evans, to your evidence, your pre-circulated evidence. The paragraph 29 at the top of page 7. You say, you talk there about and this is in terms of Rule 33, you say the discharge from the oxidation, this is about third line down on top of page 7, the discharge from the oxidation pond to land within the coastal marine area would remove this from a discretionary to a non-compliant activity. Can you just clarify what you mean there? I assume your oxidation pond's not located in the coastal marine area.
The discharge from the oxidation pond is to the coastal marine area. We were granted consent, a 25-year consent for that 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I was sort of merely highlighting the fact that in the future that discharge could be classed as a non-compliant activity, even though at the moment it wasn't covered under the proposed plan. But now it appears that following submissions, that potential non-compliant activity status could come in at a later date.
Is that in terms of the officer's recommendation to us to add a clause that any discharge is not within 20 metres of the CMA? Is that the clause that was referenced? So the treatment infrastructure, like the oxidation pond, etc., that how far away from the CMA is that? Is that removed from the CMA?
I would have to check, but probably I would say it's in the CMA.
So the oxidation pond is in the coastal marine area? Below the Menhai Water Springs, mate.
Oh, no. Sorry. No. No.
The CMA is, the boundary of the CMA is along the Menhai Water Spring.
No.
How far away is the treatment infrastructure from the Menhai Water Springs line?
Oh, it would be probably about between 50 to 100 metres away. And at a considerable height above the Menhai Low Water Spring.
The actual discharge is into the CMA, and it's fully consented at the moment.
The discharge is through three seepage ponds, right, with the pipeline from the third seepage pond into the CMA.
Okay.
So a small proportion of the flow will reach the CMA.
When you say seepage pond, are they rapid infiltration beds or something like that?
Yeah, they effectively operate that way.
Yeah. Okay. It clarifies that for me, thank you. Talked about the YR catchment. Okay, no further questions, thank you.